to SciShow Tangent, the lightly competitive science knowledge showcase. I'm your host, Hank Green. And joining me this week, as always, is science expert Sari Riley.
Hello.
And we have fellow science experts, Deboki Chakravarti and Sam Jones. It's just an all science episode today on SciShow Tangents. No every person's. We got a bunch of extra PhDs here today. Way more than usual, infinitely more. These are the hosts of the podcast Tiny Matters, which I have been on and love. So recently, I'm getting radiation treatment for my cancer. And before doing that yesterday, I decided to go do my very first CrossFit class. And that's how I know I'm an idiot.
CrossFit normally is already bad news.
I'm really curious about the steps that led to that.
So, like, there's a CrossFit gym it's very close to my house. Mm-hmm. All the other gyms would require that I get in a car, but not this one. Yeah. And so I thought maybe that would be the way to go. And honestly, it was, like, I think for CrossFit, pretty chill. Like, there was a sign on the wall that said, "Do the fucking work." But none of the people were like the sign.
That is a hard launch back into exercise.
We've all been idiots at one time in our life.
Speak for yourself. I've only ever been a genius.
Have any of us ever had, I know that this is this crowd, but like a fitness goal that we went for? Run. I know that Sari has done some running.
Yeah.
I've done some running. Yeah, I have run to the point where my body collapsed, was I did the dopey challenge, which it's right there in the name. It is run by Walt Disney World. Yeah. And it's a bunch of idiots that do it together. I did it with our friend, Nicole Sweeney, and you run a 5K one day and then a 10K the next day and then a half marathon the following day and then a full marathon the following day.
Wow.
So all 4 days in a row. You just keep pushing your body to further and further distances. And after the last day, after I finished, I just started sobbing because I didn't know. I'd put my body through so much. And my partner, Sylvia, was like, would you like me to come back to the hotel with you? And then I broke down crying. I was like, yeah, that would be nice.
But you did it, though. That's amazing.
Can you enjoy Disney anymore? Is it like, did you ruin that forever?
I think I can enjoy it. That was only my second time at Disney, I think, ever.
Okay.
And so it is like a core Disney memory now.
Yeah.
Anybody got any other fitness challenges they've done? Because no one's going to beat Sari's.
Yeah, sorry, yeah, I started.
I cannot beat that.
Yeah, I feel like I'm still like getting up to like being able to run. Like I'm happy that I can like last more than like a few minutes. Like when I was in college, I was a sprinter, and now as like an older person, you can't really sprint the way that like there's not like a show up and run 100 meters until you're like 35 and they start doing masters races. So my only choice for running is to start running like 5Ks and up, and I don't like believe in those distances, but that's my option.
So funny. I have a sort of athletic challenge, but it's more like an athletic challenge paired with a food challenge.
Way better.
I love that.
So I swam, I competed through college. So we'd swim a lot, like every day. You know, I was putting in like, depending on the day, you know, you wake up, you do a morning practice, you're in the weight room, and then in the afternoon, you come back for like 2-3 more hours. So you're swimming a lot of miles and you're very hungry. And so somehow that like sometimes would just end up as trying to see how quickly we could eat different types of food, which is disgusting. And so I think like my most impressive one was probably, I think the challenge was like, how quickly can you eat 6 hot dogs? And I think I did 6 in like less than 2 minutes. And
oh,
I think that was a high point for me in my college career.
I thought you were going to say like 5 minutes or something like that.
Leave it to college students to take like the healthiest possible lifestyle and make sure that they can find ways to make it very unhealthy.
Yeah. Like, I don't know what I was thinking, but.
Oh, I do. You're thinking I need to eat a lot of hot dogs right now. And I mean, the best part of doing CrossFit was afterward, I was so hungry and I felt like hungry in a good way.
Yeah.
I hadn't felt because I've been sick for so long, where I was just like, I'm hungry and I want to eat like healthy food. I want healthy food. That's what my body is telling me to eat. rather than
not hot dogs,
a lot of chips, which is mostly what it's been telling me to eat. It doesn't help that my doctor keeps telling me, or during chemo, was like, anything you want to eat, you should eat. And I was like, oh, thank you. I've been waiting my whole life to have a doctor tell me that. So every week here on SciShow Tangents, we get together to try to one-up, amaze, and delight each other with science facts while also trying to stay on topic. At least that's what we usually do. But years ago, when we started to do this podcast, our resident everyman, Sam Schultz, gave me this sealed envelope, and it says, to be opened in the event that Sam goes on vacation. And he told me, you'll know what to do with this when the time is right. Well, Sam is on vacation now, so I opened it. And inside, there was a VHS tape, which I'm going to play for you now.
Hello, it's Sam. If you're receiving this message, it can only mean one thing, that I'm on vacation. And without my cool, calm, but firm leadership, I expect that SciShow Tangents is on the verge of chaos. That is why I have devised a secret plan to be executed in the event of my absence. I call it the Spider Initiative. You might notice that there are two guests on today's episode. You already know Deboki Chakravarti, Tangent's esteemed research assistant and co-host of the podcast Tiny Matters. Joining her is Sam Jones, the other co-host and executive producer of Tiny Matters. And you might know these people as colleagues, peers, even friends. But today, they are your mortal enemies. As everyone knows, science podcasting is, at its heart, a competitive endeavor. Only one science podcast can be the best and the most smartest, and that is exactly what the Spider Initiative was formulated to determine, because SPIDER, you see, is an acronym. You are participating in the first ever Science Podcasters Invitational Deadly Educational Rally, Big versus Small Edition. Here's how it works. From all outward appearances, this is a normal episode of SciShow Tangents. Sari and Deboki will alternate presenting games that the rest of you will play. Points will be awarded to participants as normal. But under the surface, a metagame is roiling. The podcast co-hosts have been divided into teams. Sam and Deboki are Team Small, because they host a podcast about small things, and Hank and Sari are Team Big, because Tangents covers big, broad topics or something like that. As you gain points as an individual, you are also gaining points for your team. And at the end of both games, Team Big and Team Small's points will be combined, and one team will experience the sweetest victory while the other experiences the most bitter defeat. And in order to kick off this most auspicious occasion, I will now present the traditional science poem. Behold the vast galactic plain, where galaxies roil and stars combust. But take a closer look again, it's all made up of cosmic dust. The blue whale glides beneath the sea, surveys the murky world he rules. The largest beast to ever be, even he is made of molecules. A universe comprised of layers from big to small and back again. With this in mind, prepare yourself, players, for big versus small, let the games begin. Thus it is spoken. Let the Spider Initiative, big versus small, commence. And like, text me if you get confused about the rules or something. Have fun.
I love that. I feel like I also should have signed like a waiver coming into this. Yeah. You know, when the word deadly comes into the.
Yeah.
Yeah.
You didn't know. No, yeah, it's no good idea. To be surprised by a deadly event. So I guess that's what we're doing. And the topic for the week is big versus small. It's SciShow Tangents versus Tiny Matters. Sari, I know this is a surprise to you as well as to the rest of us, but can you tell me like what big and small are?
Yeah, I can do that softball question.
No, because sometimes big things are small. Like the biggest thing on Earth is very small in the universe.
Well, we won't think that hard.
Okay, great.
We just say if a kid can learn big and small, we can learn it too. They're opposites. Uh-huh. And I think that is what frames this episode. We are pitted against each other. Big and small are our opposite terms to describe things. So something can be small relative to something else, or something can be big relative to something else. And because
there's also like kind of just a size of things that are around usually. And some things are bigger than the average thing that might be around, and some things are smaller.
That is very true.
All frame of reference.
I like the idea that there's like a kind of normal size for a thing. Somebody's got to have done this research where like you sort of like bring by just gray orbs and you're like, is that orb big or small? And then people will be like, that one's kind of not either. And they're like, we found it. Yeah. Like this size.
So I was like trying to figure out if someone's done your gray orb experiment.
Uh-huh.
And apparently there is, this is not the experiment, but apparently there's something called Alice in Wonderland syndrome that is a neurological disorder that distorts your perception of things.
This happened to me once.
Oh?
I was walking with my future wife down a road in Florida and I saw a squirrel and I said, holy shit, that squirrel is huge. It's like the size of a corgi. And Catherine was like, that's a normal squirrel. And I was like, no, it's huge. Like, it's a world record winning squirrel. We need to chase it. And we got up to it and it was precisely squirrel sized.
Was it next to like a miniature home?
It was in
you know, those small homes?
That's what it was. It was the tiny house. It was the dollhouse it was standing next to.
It's all Tyrannosaurus
Rex squirrel. So yeah, big and small. I don't think we need to get any deeper into it. Big is like large, small is like little. And that's it.
Today we're going to learn about how we all perceive things, like whether or not we agree that something's big, whether we agree that something's small, whether that squirrel in the distance is a normal size squirrel or not.
Do you have etymology of big and small, Sari?
I do. And they are quite different, even though they kind of lump together in my brain. So big, completely unknown origin, which is happens pretty rarely, I feel like, in a word. It appeared sometime in Middle English to mean powerful or strong, and maybe came from like north-ish Scandinavian areas. But before this, in Old English, the word for like powerful or bulky or large was mickle, which is a very funny word. It's like, oh, that's mickle. We could have had mickle and small instead of big
mickle
and small.
And little.
And eventually mickle, like that word became much in linguistically. But big came out of nowhere, squashed mickle right out of here.
Yeah, I wonder if like people were just like, we like the sound of big. It's just like a fun word to say. There's a B and a G. Like those are not
same as big
commonly.
To me. It's a small word, smaller than little, but it feels big.
Feels big, feels powerful, feels right. They like the mouthfeel. They stuck with it. And then small, we do know where it comes from. It's from like Germanic-ish flavored languages. And it used to be used to describe animals or livestock in addition to like slender or thin or narrow things. But any sort of like a small thing or small was used to describe like a small animal as a concept, which I think is very interesting, which also brings in this question of what's big, what's small. And a small was just like when you thought an animal was smaller than a normal one, that's a small.
Yeah, I feel like an animal is small if I can't be afraid of it. Like once I can be afraid of an animal, like a goose is big because I can be afraid of a goose. I can definitely be afraid of a goose.
Yeah, but like a small snake is to me just as scary as a big snake.
Yeah, like what about a deadly jellyfish?
In their own, that's all that was venom is in its own category. Just physical
like really
trauma.
Gentle.
Oh, no, but I'm not just afraid of venomous snakes. I'm afraid of all of them.
But only because your brain has been trained by the venomous ones.
What about like a really gentle elephant?
It could
Are you
hurt
still
you,
scared
though.
Of it?
It could
that's
definitely,
true.
It could hurt you
if
it wanted to.
Yeah.
All right, I'm changing my mind. A small animal is one that I can easily kill. I'm switching it around. It's not about what they can do to me.
Like,
it's what about what I can do to them.
One you could pick up. You could have had
it
like a gentle.
Like carry.
Yeah.
Violence.
You're really ready for this death match.
Yeah.
Primed, ready.
So that means it's time that we're going to move on to the quiz portion of our show with our first game and our big versus small death rally presented this game by Sari. What are we going to do?
While declassified documents can be fodder for conspiracy theorists or, in some cases, super valid disillusionment about the lack of consent in so many experiments, U.S. government projects are full of big budgets, big ideas, and big mistakes. Mm-hmm. So this is a Truth or Fail Express, big weird government science, a.k.a. while I could have talked about whales or trees or exoplanets, for some reason, my brain was like, wow, you know what would be great for a science comedy podcast? Talking about the enormous hubris of powerful white Americans in the 20th century. And this is the game I have, so there's no going back.
It's the one we're going to do.
This is what I've chosen to encapsulate the idea of big.
This is our Barbenheimer.
Yeah, this is, maybe that's it. Barbenheimer has infiltrated my brain. And I was like, this is great. So there'll be four rounds of this Truth or Fail Express. The first story is, natural gas is a hydrocarbon fuel source that's mostly methane. And generally, we mine it from reservoirs in sedimentary rock by drilling holes or making cracks somehow. But in 1967, Project Gas Buggy detonated a 26-kiloton nuclear device underground in New Mexico to extract a lot of natural gas all at once from a sandstone well. So the question is Project Gas Buggy real or not?
It's gotta be real. We were doing it. Well, it was definitely proposed because they proposed using nuclear bombs to do everything in the 60s. They were like, problem solved. You want a new, like, Suez Canal bothering you? Let's do a new one with nuclear bombs. Do it through Israel. It'll be fine.
What was the year again of Project Gas Buggy?
1967.
Oh, okay. Interesting. What a funny name for a project.
You know, I think they probably didn't end up doing it.
I also kind of think not, mostly just because the name is so funny.
It's the name. The name's getting me. I'm going to say false, but this is totally something that would happen. But the name is throwing me off.
Did we all guess no?
Yeah, we all guessed no.
You're all wrong. It is real. It did happen.
The cracktual ground.
They moved the actual. So the Atomic Energy Commission was a program that was organized in June 1957 to develop peaceful uses for nuclear explosives, which I think is the funniest tagline.
It's like an oxymoron, but
yeah.
And now with that context, the name makes sense. Like the name is the branding thing.
We gotta make it sound cute and fun.
Gas buggy.
Yeah.
It became the Division of Peaceful Nuclear Explosives in 1961. And they, like Hank was saying, came up with ideas to use nuclear blasts to build harbors or dams or highways or canals and stimulate the economy. And in 1967, this commission combined efforts with the El Paso Natural Gas Company, because of course it's a corporate thing also, to blow up a sealed well and try and harvest natural gas from it. But they didn't really think the plan through, because once you detonate a nuclear bomb beneath the surface of the earth, even if that radiation doesn't spread, if you then try to harvest the natural gas, it is irradiated. And that's a problem. You can't use that.
And then when you burn it, it's still irradiated. Like, you don't burn away the atoms.
It doesn't go away. And they did this multiple times, too. Like, there is Project Rulison, named after the community in Colorado. I think that's how you say it. Rulison. Where they did it again. They were like, let's harvest more natural gas by detonating a nuclear device. Very dumb.
Yeah, and then we can transport the radiation out of the well to places near people and burn it.
Yeah.
Into horrible. The air.
You all got that one wrong. We're off to a strong... Yeah. I feel...
We didn't even really have the right reason to get it wrong. Like, we should have said, no, that's stupid. Why would you take irradiated gas out of the ground?
So, story number two. We got three more of these.
We need to stop talking so much. Yeah.
So story number two is the rat flea, Xenocyla chiopsis, is small in size, but it has a big impact on disease transmission. In 1954, to see whether fleas could be a possible biological warfare agent, Operation Big Itch dropped groups of 100,000 to 200,000 fleas from planes onto a bunch of literal guinea pigs in the Utah desert. Is Operation Big Itch real or not?
The guinea pigs is the part this time that's getting me, and that I'm going to find out is like the reason I should believe this.
I think Operation Big Itch is real. Because they definitely want to drop fleas on people.
I just feel like they would have gone straight for humans.
It's just fleas.
I'm going to say false. I feel like there are a lot of things that have a lot of attempts at dropping things on other countries that are like microbes or insects, things like that. But I've never come across fleas. And I feel like maybe I would have in my research for some of the episodes we've done.
Yeah. I mean, one vote against this is that you don't like need to drop fleas on soldiers. Like they already got them in the trenches. Yeah.
I see what you're saying.
Yeah. It's not a good vibe already. Like the misery yeah. is close to peak, but I'm still saying it was real.
I'm going to say it's true just to spread out, just to do a strategy, because I don't know the answer.
Thanks, Tavoki.
Yeah.
For the gameplay. Yeah. Well, this is real. It is true.
Oh my gosh. Wow.
Wowie.
The naming of these is just mind-blowing to me.
Yeah. I found some fun. This is like what spurred the game in my late night delusions. Like, these are so funny and weird. It's comedy, guys. all this warfare. So these tests in Operation Big Itch showed that fleas could survive the drop and would soon attach themselves to these animal hosts on the ground. They were literal guinea pigs in a 600 meter-ish in diameter circular grid. But part of the problem of these tests, they were trying to figure out the best like encapsulation of these fleas, were that they didn't create good enclosures. And in the 200,000 flea cases, the pilot, the bombardier, and observers on the planes were also bitten many times.
Oh,
like,
no.
The fleas escaped, yeah. Which, like, they probably deserved it. But that made me, like,
God.
Like 100,000 fleas, manageable. 200,000 fleas, unconscionable. Like, we can't do it. Too many.
Physics breaks. And the guinea pigs get their revenge. All right, all right. Okay, so we're doing all right here. Here on team whatever I am. Big.
We're big.
Big.
Yes, please say thanks. There's only two options. Okay, so story number three is that there have been many efforts to try and control weather, such as by scattering a dusty substance in a cloud to act as nucleation sites for rain. But in 1946, Project North Pole had a more specific goal. Using 20 tons or around 40,000 pounds of granular dry ice, which is frozen carbon dioxide, they brought snow to the Florida panhandle to try and break a deadly heat wave.
Well, this is the least stupid name, so I don't think it's real.
I know.
How are you going to break a heat wave with just dry ice? Just like spread it around? Did they put it in the sky? Did I miss
this? They put it in the sky. Yes. Okay. Yeah. So it was like a cloud seeding. So they wanted to seed the clouds so that there was snow falling.
I have no idea how well dry ice does at certain elevations. Like, I don't know how much, like, how much would that?
The problem again is like that just because it doesn't make sense doesn't mean that it's not.
I know, like the nuclear bomb thing. Like, so, yeah. I shouldn't use logic with this. I should use feelings.
My feeling is that it's false.
My feeling is also that it is false.
Me too. But Tabogi, should I just say true? Can we sidebar for a sec?
Yeah.
All right, I'm gonna say
do
true.
We play with strategy?
Go to the confessional.
I think you should go with your feelings.
Yes, I agree.
I feel like it's false.
You're all correct. It is false.
Yes. Oof.
This is a brain invention of my own.
I like
it was
that,
based
though.
in a little bit of truth. So in the 1940s or so, there was research done at General Electric on cloud particles and cloud modifications. And the reason I found this fact was because Kurt Vonnegut, like the author, he had a physicist brother named Bernard. And Bernard Vonnegut was a physicist at GE working on weather seeding and like cloud particles and whatnot. Very weird. And so he like collaborated with an atmospheric scientist and a Nobel laureate to like try to figure out ways to control weather. And as one of these experiments, very small and in Schenectady, New York, like upstate New York, they made a little bit of snow at one point using dry ice in a cloud, but there was no like grander purpose to it. It was just like, can we make weather in some way?
Yeah. That's going to be like, the whole future. It's going to be real messy, you guys.
Okay. This is the last one. So story number four is before the United States Space Force even existed as a branch of the military, there was obviously tons of experimentation with space technology for exploration, defense, and the like. In 1987, a project called Brilliant Pebbles began the research and development of small, lightweight spacecraft that were meant to orbit the Earth in fleets of up to 100,000 detect any missiles launched outside the atmosphere with infrared sensors and destroy them by colliding with them at high speeds. Is the project Brilliant Pebbles real or not?
How would the pebbles move around?
They're spacecraft.
Oh.
They're small, lightweight spacecraft.
I got confused
but
they're by the
just name. Called pebbles. Yeah, yeah, yeah. It's a tongue-in-cheek name, you know?
Just like picturing fruity pebbles, yeah. Like aiming at an asteroid or something, yeah. Or a missile.
Yeah. Yeah, they're going fast enough.
I'm going with my name thing, which is like, if this feels like a government name, like it's got to be a government project. And this feels like a government name.
They wanted to make it sound like a breakfast cereal, but actually be a military project.
I'm going to go true on this.
Both going true.
Yeah.
I could take the risk.
You sure could.
But I think it's real, though. So I should go with my gut. Well, yeah. Yeah, it's real. We're idiots.
And you are all right. It is real. Brilliant Pebbles did exist.
Sometimes I'm like hoping we're wrong because that just seems so unreasonable, but that's fine.
This one I was hoping was right. I liked this one. I like this idea. It just, again, the name. I like the idea that there's a file somewhere that says Brilliant Pebbles.
So this was part of the Strategic Defense Initiative in like the Reagan era of presidency. Cold War was, tensions were going on and they were like, how can we defend ourselves? And of course, the scientists came up with a solution of like, let's launch 100,000 little spacecraft.
Yeah.
Because why not? Because then we can constantly monitor whether a missile is going to come and deter it. They developed these like little light spacecraft or like looked into what it would take to build one, but they never actually, obviously, I think we would know if there were this many like small things orbiting the Earth all of a sudden. But the technology was actually used in another way, which was a little bit surprising. In 1994, a U.S. spacecraft called Clementine was launched to the moon. It was the first since Explorer 49 in 1973. And it was designed and built to image the moon. And so it transmitted about 1.6 million digital images of the lunar surface.
Yeah, we got the most brilliant pebble of all.
Yeah. Aww. A little guy. Good little rock. Yeah. Doing his best.
Well, we've come out with Team Little with 5 points and Team Big with just 3. But we didn't have a lot of opportunities to get points in that game. Next time, Team Big has its chance for a comeback. But first, we're going to take a short break and we'll be back for Team Small's game.
SciShow Tangents is brought to you by Rocket Money, a personal finance app that finds and cancels your unwanted subscriptions, monitors your spending, and helps lower your bills so that you can grow your savings. Money is annoying. You have to remember so much stuff, like your bank account password and your PIN number. You got to balance your checkbook, and I don't even know what that means to balance your checkbook. You got to put all your receipts in a folder or something probably too. And who has time for all that? Not me, the old money dummy himself. But if you don't manage your finances, there can be dire consequences. Like maybe, for instance, you pay your utility bill twice. Huh?
You know, we all make mistakes. We all move sometimes. My partner and I moved recently. I didn't think to check the old utility accounts, but then I was doing my taxes and going through all the utility bills. And we logged into our old account and I was like, what the heck? There's a couple $100 bill here for an apartment that we don't live in anymore. Mm. What's going on here?
The electric company's just like, thank you very much.
Yeah. And I was just too busy and too tired to figure out that out until mid-February when I was like, oh, shoot. But boy, would it have been easier if we had an app that said, you're paying your utility bill twice.
The unfortunate truth of the matter is it's important to keep on top of your finances. But the fortunate truth is that Rocket Money exists. Rocket Money gives you a clear view of your expenses, letting you see your spending in one place at a glance. Rocket Money gives you the power to easily track your monthly spending, create custom budgets, and even find and cancel unwanted subscription services, and also potentially utility bills for old apartments you don't live in anymore. Rocket Money has over 5 million users and has saved a total of $500 million in canceled subscriptions, saving members up to $740 a year when you use all the app's features.
Stop wasting money on things you don't use, like subscription services, and stop paying your power bill twice, like I almost did. Thankfully, didn't. Cancel your unwanted subscriptions and manage your finances the easy way by going to rocketmoney.com/tangents. That's rocketmoney.com/tangents. rocketmoney.com/TANGENTS.
And now, Deboki, please tell me, what do you have for us?
Okay, well, sometimes the goal of science is to make things big, like some of what Sari was talking about. But also, sometimes science wants to do the complete opposite and take things that like maybe exist at a certain size and make them even smaller. So today we're playing This or That Small Things Edition. Okay. I'm going to tell you about some kind of wild scientific feat of miniaturization. And then I'm going to describe that object. And then I'm going to describe some other object. And it's going to be up to you to figure out which one is smaller. So in 2021, researchers found a way to make tiny human hearts using stem cells that had been exposed to proteins and other molecules that are known to shape heart development in the womb. Within a week, the cells created a chamber-like structure similar to the left ventricle, and the walls began to contract, sort of like a heartbeat. The scientists named their tiny hearts cardioids. So, which is smaller, the diameter of one of these cardioids or the diameter of a typical mouse heart?
I mean, I assumed cardioids were way smaller than a mouse heart.
Yeah, I'm going to say the cardioids.
That is my instinct, too.
Like, I'm thinking like not like an M&M, but like a runt. That's how I'm feeling about cardioids. Yeah. Imagine eating them.
A little snack.
I wasn't, but now.
I'm going to go with my heart, and I'm going to say the cardioid is smaller because you can make it at whatever size you want.
Well, you're all correct. So a mouse heart typically has a diameter of around 6 millimeters. The diameters of these cardioids were around 1 millimeter. So like still kind of tough to eat, but like super small and cool. So the scientists made these cardioids so that they can actually study how congenital heart defects develop in human embryos, which I thought was really neat. Like obviously it's kind of hard to like peer into a human embryo to see what's going on. But like being able to kind of build these little cardioids and see them develop lets us like know more about how the heart develops and hopefully will help us understand more about how heart defects develop in the womb. They actually also tested it further by using a steel rod, a cold one, to freeze parts of the cardioid so like that some of the cells would get damaged. And they actually could see cells coming in to repair those bits. So super cool. Like, oh, cool. Just really interesting.
That's awesome. Me.
I mean, it turns out that mouse hearts are like runt sized.
You could eat a whole handful of them, Hank, if you wanted, like a box of runts.
Like a box
you
of
tip
runts.
It back and you go.
That's actually what runts are. They're candy coated mouse hearts.
Oh, little did you know.
Okay. So hearts are not the only organs that scientists have tried to shrink. Scientists have also designed miniature brains for various purposes, including my favorite one, which is to play a game. In 2022, scientists reported that they were able to make a miniature brain that they called Dish Brain, which used a mixture of human and mouse neurons grown on an electrode array. And nice. With their design, they were actually able to teach Dish Brain how to play Pong.
No.
So what was smaller, Dish Brain or a CD-ROM?
Ooh, I feel like Dish Brain and a CD-ROM are very similar sizes. Ooh. I was definitely picturing just a Petri dish, which is smaller than a CD-ROM, but not substantially. Do you mean diameter?
Yeah, sorry, diameter. Yeah. Okay.
Dish Brain. I know that it's interesting and we got to keep learning things about the world, but sometimes I feel like we shouldn't make a mouse-human hybrid play Pong.
What do you think we should make it play, if not Pong?
Yeah, Mortal Kombat, probably. Something really violent.
Yeah, as long as it's still small, which means Hank can kill it, then we're safe. I also think I'm going to go with my gut instinct. I'm also picturing a Petri dish, so I'm also going to say it's smaller than a CD-ROM.
Yeah, me too. Yeah.
Cool. You're all correct again. A standard CD has a diameter of around 4.75 inches, and the dish brain had a diameter of 2 inches.
At least based on what I could find.
So, like, they weren't using a Petri dish. From what I understood, they were, like, using, like, a specific array that's basically kind of designed to hold these electrodes. So there were 1,024 active electrodes surrounded by around 800,000 neurons, which is apparently roughly the same number of neurons in a bee's brain. And so they basically created the system where the electrodes were creating signals that are sort of like pixels, like in terms of like if you imagined like the ball, except instead of it being like light, it's just electrical signals. And so you can move that around to create this sense of a ball moving through the dish that the neurons are interacting with. And then the system in turn had like a, what they call kind of like a game controller system where the neurons are responding with their own signals that are then get interpreted as a sort of paddle movement. And so that the program would process what the neurons responded with and then send a second signal back to basically be a feedback that would let the neurons know, like, were they successful with the ball? The neurons were able to get better at Pong within 5 minutes. And after 20 minutes, they were up to doing short rallies.
I do like that they saw this like 2-inch thing and they were like, that's a dish.
They're using the like the ultimate human method of bullying to put down the thing that we're scared of. And say, oh, you're dish brain. as opposed to like this incredible, terrifying mutant human mouse neuron thing.
Yeah.
All right. Well, geez, we got to start getting some of these wrong, you guys. Somebody does, particularly Sam.
Okay. So to study 3D vision, like if we want to study it in humans, we have to be able to show independent images to our left and our right eyes so we can understand how the differences in those images they're receiving helps our brain construct the three-dimensional image that we then like see. And one way to do that is with your standard old school 3D glasses that have those red blue lenses. But that's kind of hard to do if you're a scientist who wants to understand 3D vision in praying mantises. They need something a little bit smaller. And so some scientists were like, hey, we know how to do this. We're going to make miniature 3D glasses for praying mantises. So what is smaller, the diameter of the lens on a praying mantis 3D glass or the diameter of a new pencil eraser?
I'm going to say the mantis glass or glasses that's that smaller.
Too. I'm going to say the pencil eraser. I feel like they got big old eyes and I don't know.
Have you ever met a praying mantis?
No, I have not.
Okay.
Well, it seems like she still has knowledge of their eyes because, the pencil eraser is the smaller one.
Whoa.
Yeah, so pencil erasers have a diameter of like around 5 millimeters. The lenses for these mantises, they're shaped like a teardrop, but I decided to pretend that they were a circle and their widest diameter was around 7 millimeters.
Whoa.
To actually put these glasses on the mantis, the scientists would put the mantis in a freezer for 5 to 7 minutes and then put them under the microscope lens put the mantis in like modeling clay. So like they're kind of frozen. Now they're stuck in clay. And then they put the glasses onto the mantis using beeswax and rosin to like hold them in place.
I was like, I don't think a mantis has a very good nose bridge. So I was just kind of curious how they.
No, it's glue. You just glue it basically onto them.
I'm looking and you can see them. They took pictures. He looks basically he's saying, why is this happening to me?
Yep. I never thought I could see despair on a praying mantis's face, but you can see it.
Okay. Like, so our last one, in 2022, NASA launched Nachos into space.
Nachos stands for NanoSat Atmospheric Chemistry Hyperspectral Observation System. And it's an imager designed to help us find trace gases in small areas on Earth with the hope that it will help us study pollution and volcanoes and other gas-emitting things. So what is smaller, the volume of nachos or a jar of queso blanco from Target?
Do I get a free pass because I'm lactose intolerant or like is that not?
Queso blanco is very, I know exactly the size of that. I'm very familiar with the size of that. And it's not very big. I have to say that queso blanco is smaller.
If I were a scientist coming up with a nacho satellite, how small would I make it? I'm going to say the satellite. I'm I feel like they're really trying to make things small these days.
Yeah. Mm. I'm going to go satellite as well.
Cool. So we have satellites. Hank, what was your answer?
Queso blanco.
Okay. You're doing queso blanco. the satellite is smaller. Ugh. So at least the jar of queso blanco that I found on Target's website is 15 fluid ounces or 27 cubic inches in volume. Nachos, the NanoSat Atmospheric Chemistry Hyperspectral Observation System, is 18 cubic inches. Mm. Wow. And this is pretty exciting, like in general. Like there are satellites that people use to monitor trace gases, but the instruments on them are really big. They need a lot of power, and they're not usually able to gather a lot of super fine detail about where the gases actually are that they find. They're, you know, usually finding them more in kind of like a coarse regional basis. But the technology underlying NACHOS comes from the Los Alamos National Laboratory, and it uses this thing called hyperspectral imaging, where you're getting kind of like all of these pixels of information, but instead of having colors in those pixels, you have like hundreds of wavelength bands that are the spectral markers of different gases. And so then you can sift through them to find the gas that you're particularly interested in. And so they launched it in 2022. And at the time, they said it would probably run for about a year so that scientists could see whether or not it works well. So hopefully it did.
Awesome. Yeah. Now, how big was the queso blanco jar that you saw on Target.com?
It was 15 fluid ounces.
Okay. I think that's the average size.
Yeah.
All right. Well, Tuna, while we've been chatting, has done the math. Team Big comes out on top with 9 points, just above your 8 points. There's only wow, one science close. Podcast that reigns supreme. And yeah. The emperor of the Ottoman Empire, upon seeing people drinking illegal coffee in the streets, I must now behead you by surprise with a broadsword.
Man, games are really going to be different on tangents going forward.
Yeah.
Yeah, the vibe's going to change a lot. Also, yeah. We won't have you to like help out with the show, which is going to make it harder.
Yeah.
But what has to be done has to be done.
It's true.
And now it is time to very quickly ask our newly enlarged science couch, because we've been going for a long time. We've got a question for this illustrious group of finely honed scientific minds. It's from Chris on Discord and from @MayaByard. Yeah, that's as good as I'm going to do. They both ask, what is the smallest single-celled organism and how does it exist at such a small size? Now, Deboki and Sam, you got to know that always we begin with me trying to pull the answer out of my butt. But like this one, it's got to be a bacteria or archaea.
Yeah.
One of you guys. Yeah.
I know. I'm like, what is the smallest though of the of bacteria? I don't know.
What situations would it be good to be small in?
I think it's more what is the naming that they would use that we can guess. And then we can sound like really smart when we guess the right name.
Sarah,
Latin. Harvest bacteria.
Yeah. Okay. Is it a bacteria or archaea? Which
is it? Both of those. A bacteria is what I found most of, but we have very small archaea too. And Deboki, you were right with the nomenclature that you were headed down. Not 100%, but bacteria are super messy genetically, taxonomically, etc. How they're related to each other. It's hard for us to tell. So there's a pretty big group of related bacteria phyla called the candidate phyla radiation, or CPR for short. And basically that means these candidate bacteria are well characterized genetically, but haven't been cultured. We haven't grown them in labs and just know that they exist because we found their DNA. Mm. And the CPR group contains some of the smallest living organisms we know of called ultramicrobacteria. So they just took two words for small.
Wow.
Or super small. And then we're like, that's the name we're going to call
them.
Man,
but Parvis would have been so good.
And it's possible that there is a specific bacterial phyla or phylum that has that name. So from what I can tell, ultramicrobacteria in general, the first time they were described was in a 1981 paper studying tiny colonies of bacteria in seawater. They were defined as proliferating cells, so like healthy growing bacterial cells that were less than 0.1 micrometers cubed in volume. And they have really small genomes, like 3.2 to 0.5-ish megabases of a genome. And they're missing a lot of proteins, particularly ribosome proteins, which are helping with protein synthesis. So our guess is that these ultramicrobacteria rely on other bacteria to help them survive. So some sort of parasitic relationship. They might have some like external structures to help them take nutrients or, I don't know, fill in the capabilities that these minimized genomes don't let them. And they have weird names. So all of these CPR group bacteria, from what I can tell, they have like an acronym name based on where they were found. And then if we like them enough, we give them a fancy name. So in a 2015 study from UC Berkeley, they actually imaged three ultramicrobacteria phyla from groundwater samples. And the three that they imaged were WWE3, which was named from wastewater of every three because it was from every France and collected from municipal anaerobic sludge there. And they were like, oh, WWE3. But then it was later named Catanobacteria from the Hebrew word katan, which translates to small. And so that's why I think, like, with your Latin, there must be one.
I don't know why we always have to, like, go to other languages. I think that we could just call it, like, Actinobacter baby.
Small bacter.
A smallobacter. So if you want to ask the Science Couch your question, you can follow us on Twitter at @SciShowTangents, where we'll tweet out topics for upcoming episodes every week. Or you could join the SciShow Tangents Patreon and ask us on our Discord. Thank you to @TrisketBells, Mike2369, and everybody else who asked us your questions for this episode. Deboki and Sam, how can we find Tiny Matters?
Tiny Matters, you can find us on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Google Podcasts, wherever
all
else you listen.
Places. Yes.
All the podcast places. And we also have transcripts available for all of our episodes at acs.org/Tiny Matters.
Where would I start if I was going to watch some Tiny Matters?
So we did do an episode on the huge potential of psychedelic-assisted therapy.
I listened to that episode. Yeah.
For mental health. Yeah. So, you know, drugs like psilocybin, LSD, ketamine, how they're already being used to treat conditions like anxiety and depression. And then also why psychedelic research was on the rise in the 60s, but then all but vanished in the 70s. So that was a pretty fun one. We had Hank on the show back in February. We talked about communicating science and the millions of things that he does, including SciShow Tangents. So definitely check that one out. The main thing that I do is work as exec producer of Tiny Matters and co-host it with Deboki, but I do a bunch of other writing and things. So you can find me on social everywhere at Sam J Science. There's a lot of Sam Joneses out there. So
yeah,
I feel like I have to just a lot of
the
Sams.
The science one.
Yeah, the science one.
There's only a few Deboki Chakravartis, but I go by Okie Dokie Boki on the internet just to make it harder.
But you're the best. You're the best of them.
Thank you. Thank you.
If you like this show and you want to help us out, it's super easy to do that. You can go to patreon.com/SciShowTangents to become a patron and get access to our bonus episodes and our newsletter. And don't forget, when we hit 700 patrons, I swear it will happen. We will do a Minions movie commentary. Or maybe we've already hit 700. We're very close. And Sam's not here to tell me. Either way, go subscribe, because the only way you can hear that is if you're a Patreon patron. And I know that it's the only thing that's missing from your very rich life. Second, you can leave us a review wherever you listen. That helps us know what you like about the show and helps other people find us. And finally, if you want to show your love for SciShow Tangents, just tell people about us. Thank you for joining us. I've been Hank Green.
I've been Sari Riley.
I've been Deboki Chakravarti.
I've been Sam Jones.
And I've been Hank Green. SciShow Tangents is created by all of us. And produced usually by Sam Schultz. I guess he still produced this episode. He certainly was in charge of it. Our associate producer is Eve Schmidt. Our editor is Seth Glitzman. Our story editor is Alex Billow. Our social media organizer is Julia Buzz Bazzio. Our editorial assistant is Deboki Chakravarti. Our sound design is by Joseph Tunamedish. Our executive producers are Nicole Sweeney and me, Hank Green. And of course, we couldn't make any of this without our patrons on Patreon. Thank you. And remember, the mind is not a vessel to be filled, but a fire.
But one more thing. leafcutter ant, Ada leavigata, has lots of names in various South American Spanish dialects, which in English roughly translate to big-bottomed ant or the slightly raunchy fat-ass ant. And they have so many names because they're a seasonal delicacy in many cultures. Their massive nests are 10 to 20 feet underground and contain millions of ants. And during late spring, when there's heavy rain, a bunch of queens emerge from their colonies with huge butts full of unfertilized eggs. They're ready to seek out mates, but many of them get snatched up by predators, including hungry humans. Then these small ants with big butts get soaked in salt water, roasted or fried, and eaten as a crunchy, protein-rich snack.
You know, I thought it would just be raw, was my thought. But now that they're cooked, I'm kind of interested.
Now, my question is a big butt ant's butt smaller or bigger than a cardioid? What is it?
Yeah.